Accession number 26864, reel 13.
Arthur Caney, reel 13. So you went to Uganda at the time of independence?
Yes.
Yeah. And did you know much about Uganda? I mean, you'd been in Africa for a while, hadn't you?
Yes, I knew a lot about Uganda and all about King's African Rifles. And this was the 4th Battalion, the King's African Rifles. And to go there at independence and then to be able to control the finances for the quartermaster set up, that's housing, feeding, and accommodation, clothing. It was a very worthwhile job.
It was a different country, different army. I mean, was it very different from how you'd had to work in?
No, it was exactly as we had it before, but as independence came on, we had the African officers being trained, a few in Sandhurst, at Sandhurst, still hadn't returned from Sandhurst. And we had 6 warrant officers. They were made effendis, which is PSI, which is platoon sergeant major, prior to being commissioned. And they were wonderful. I knew them so well because they'd had the same sort of service that I'd had, sergeant majors. So really, and they were the salt of the earth, we thought at the time. Number one, they were given numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Number one was Idi Amin,
right,
who at that time was a great friend of mine. Well, they all were.
Right. What sort of age was he then?
Well, they had 22 years, so it was 1830, 38, 40.
Right. And you got on with him well?
Well, with all of them. I was fortunate because I was respected in the King's African Rifles because of my age, my experience, and also I was the person who supplied the soldiers with what they wanted, except their pay, of course. So really, I couldn't go wrong. And also, I had learnt the language. I think I've told you about that before.
So tell me about Idi Amin, because I remember him, pictures of him. He was a bit bloated, he was arrogant.
No, he was, in my time, a very tall, fit man, and I used to bring the African officers and a couple of British officers to my place once a month, in the same camp, but in my quarters. My wife was there, and we had a veranda with a barrel of beer, and they used to come and enjoy their time. I've got a tape of them singing. I've got it there, but unfortunately I've broken it. And I've got a friend of mine coming who's going to tape it together. But with the regimental songs. And also thanking me for inviting them along on a special occasion.
And these were the black Ugandan,
yes,
officers,
yes,
including Idi Amin.
Yes. Oh, yes, they were very great friends of mine. And if I wanted anything done, I could always phone them up. And they would do anything.
Like what?
Well, I mean, get some extra chaps to come, some change my staff. If I've had somebody who was not very good, I could always get someone to replace them. And anything I wanted done, they would help.
Was there any difference in the way of dealing with the officers who were men who were indigenous to the country and those who, you know, were British stock? Was there any sort of allowances made, or any difference at all?
Well, we had different quarters. We had, yes, of course, we had proper army standard quarters, which they were so well fitted out. I mean, right down to all officer ranks and other ranks. We had 6 other ranks, I think, at independence. And that included port glasses, sherry glasses, and all that, which later on, 2 years later, when I handed it over to the officers, the Africans, they took all that over. All the crockery, everything was exactly the same. So they, once they became independent and took a rank in the army, they were treated with everything exactly the same as we'd had before.
Right. And would a black officer, if he was sharing accommodation, would he ever share it with a white officer, or would they
Well, no, later on, well, before independence, there were so few white officers there, well, and after independence, so all the time, there's so few. So you had the company commander, who obviously had his own accommodation, and the other officers would be technical, like signalers, mortars, and MTO, they would have theirs. So it didn't really affect them. But later on, when we were all in the mess together, everybody messed together, fed together, and after independence, they introduced some of their own food. Then they found they didn't want their own food. They wanted to go back to the British way of cooking because they got so used to it, I suppose. And, of course, I mean, they had a dish called matoki, which was bananas, boiled up as we boil up and make mashed potatoes. They had this, which was quite a reasonable dish to go with the rest of the food. So all in all, they enjoyed living the same food and things as we did.
So when you first knew Idi Amin, I mean, did you see any signs that he had leadership qualities? Because he became the leader of his country in one way or another.
He did. Well, as it went, there's a long story, but when you come to the end of this, about a week before I left, he was then the commander of the army. And he called me into his office, and he'd had a contractor sat there who'd come to him to get the contract for meat, I think it was. Now, he's Somali, which is... We'd had this contract for years, and I'd always given him the contract because he was the best, and he produced a good food, a reasonable price, and he had the contract. I'd already arranged for him to have that contract, but unfortunately, he went to Edie, which is later the African way of doing things, thinking he would get the contract. And he knew he couldn't come to me because he knew I wouldn't have changed my ideas from what he said. So there's Edie came. So I was a bit indignant when he called me and asked me to give it to him. So I had to say to him, well, he's already got the contract. So from that time on, I didn't have much time for Edie. And when I left, I didn't shake hands with him because I could see what was going to happen.
So in the time you were there, which was how long were you in Uganda?
2 years.
2 years. So in that time, he'd progressed from being an officer.
Which was
a junior officer, was he?
Well, yes, he became a lieutenant,
yeah.
Then a captain. Mm-hmm. And then he came up, and at one time he was the CO of the unit. Mm-hmm. This is after a mutiny, which came later.
Right. So in 2 years, he'd risen to be head of...
Oh, yes. And
how
later,
did he do that?
Well, there's nobody else to take the... But there was an independent country. You see, what happened, after about 12 months, we'd trained, all the officers that had been trained, some from Sandhurst, and a lot of, about six, including those six, they'd gone on training at Nakuru, under a British officer who was later a colonel in the SAS. He was training them at Nakuru, and it worked very well. But unfortunately, after independence, President Obote, he and other of his political friends put forward the names of their nephews and so on, and friends, to the officers, the team, who were selecting the officers. The selection team. Now, they weren't good enough. They were below standard. That's why the African officers and so on, they had been screened, and they were good quality, reliable, and they'd been taught well. And unfortunately, the politicians sent six officers off to Moscow to be trained in Russia, or to Russia to be trained.
Had you known that was going to happen before they went, or this just...
No. We didn't know until they came back. Now, they'd only been there for 6 weeks, and they were no good.
What had they been taught? I mean...
Well, what could they be taught in Russia? To be anti-British, I suppose, in those days. But the point is, the soldiers, the African soldiers, didn't want anything to do with them. Because they were not of the correct standard. And unfortunately, I had a bit of a barney in the mess with one, and two of the African officers then took him outside and told him. But you could see it was going to lead up to trouble. Because out of a battalion, they were going to form two other battalions. To do that, they had to promote all the people in the one battalion to make three. It's impossible to try and produce three sets of officers and senior ranks from one battalion. But this is what they had to do. Therefore, the standard dropped. So it had the building up of trouble. But also, after independence, it became tribal.
Right. So when you first went there, the tribal element was coming in then, was it?
No. Up until the time of independence, when the British handed over to the Africans, everything had been non-tribal. All the tribes were mixed together in each platoon. The only ones that were slightly separate were the Somalis, who were more educated than the others, and they were the signalers. They were only the signalers because no one else could do it. They were not put as Somalis for that job. But everything else, and it worked well in the battalion for all those years since 1906 when the British started training them. So for all those years, we had the tribes mixed up in one battalion, all the time working wonderfully well. Now, it's the same with the politicians. At independence, suddenly, they voted in a Botes tribe. But to make it easy at that time, King Freddie was from the Buganda tribe. He became the Minister of Defence. And I remember sitting at the dinner table. They were all invited. Not long after independence, they'd all got their new jobs. And there was Milton Obote, King Freddie, the African officers, and a few, the British officers had gradually been posted away. So there were about four British officers left, sat on this table. And I remember a funny thing happening. African servants came round, and they had a mixed grill on the plate, and you had to pick up. So I was talking to somebody on my right, and when I think of it, it's so silly. The man had his thumb over the top of the plate. So I was going like this, and he was pulling the plate back, and it took me some time to realise I was pricking his finger, thinking it's a sausage. It was so silly when you think of it. Yeah.
And what was the talk of at that dinner? What was,
Well, amongst them was a couple of King Freddy's nephews. They'd been getting a job, which we didn't. They hadn't been passed. But as I said, they had been promoted for political reasons, which was fair enough in this way, I think, because of a different. Otherwise, they would have edged away what they became later, one tribe. But at that time, this was just about 6 weeks after independence, they were all fresh, and we still had more control over them. And it was a happy time. And one nephew, he was very indignant that during the war he'd only been promoted to sergeant. He hadn't been allowed to become an officer. He was very indignant, which I suppose, looking back from his point of view, was fair enough.
So they were optimistic. They felt they were in an effective army and they were going to be part of it.
Oh, yes. And what was so good about it was, we had always brought them up to bring one wife and two children only in the camp at the same time, because we didn't have accommodation. But they were, from a religious point of view, allowed four wives. But the young ones would start off with no wife. Then they'd get one wife, which would they bring in. Now, after a time, they get more money in the kitty, and they had a good system by which, in their home, in their village, they would leave their wife at home to look after the garden, the chicken and the goats and so on. But as soon as they had enough money, they bought another wife. So therefore, the youngest and prettiest wife they would bring to the camp. The other one would go back, instead of in the bedroom, they'd go to the kitchen and the garden. And as they got more money, they would get another one. So they went in sequence. The youngest would be in the bedroom, the second would be in the kitchen, and the third one would be in the garden. So after the fourth one, they got two in the garden. But only in Uganda, in the barracks, would they have one wife and two children. Now, they would change over when the man went on leave. That was part of the rules. It was very well organised. Later on, I used to talk to them about this. And every wife had the same entitlement. And they had, if they did things wrong, if the man did things wrong, they were called on the coals by the religious leaders or the elders in the village. So it was something that had been going on for hundreds of years, and it was well controlled.
How did the British wives and the white wives take to these, the black wives?
Well, we didn't have any wives there. My wife was there, the two I see wife, and in the early days, well, in Uganda, most had gone, ready to go off. So we finished up with two wives, three wives there, I think. Well, the point is, we got to a stage where, after some time, as all the officers were being posted away, and the wives were posted away, we finished up with a training team, which consisted of the training major, myself, and the paymaster. So there were four officers there, and I think my wife then was, and the two IC. And my wife and the two IC's wife used to look after them every month or every week, I don't know how many times, they used to have meetings with the African wives, and they would help by acting as also as nurses to the children. And it was wonderful, really. The system they had was, everybody was happy and it was wonderful. And at least I used to think so, because there were smiling faces, everybody's happy, wonderful, smiling, happy people. And my wife went off with the 2IC once a month to a leper colony, where they would do all sorts of things, talk and take things to them. And they were doing good things, really.
So it sounds a happy time. Few hints then of what was to come in Uganda's history.
Well, the
tribes were integrating, weren't they?
They were.
Jobs at that time.
Well, up to we had 12 months where everybody, we were there training with them, a few of us, and we worked very well. But they hadn't yet got down to into tribal problems, and each company, one company, would go off on safari into the wilds, and they were showing the flag, really. And it was very interesting, because I would go off and take things up to them and go up to visit. Very interesting. And then I had to go up once by a Piper plane, two-seater, very small police plane, to recognise a site for a camp, right up into a place called Karamoja, which is up on the Ethiopian border and the Sudanese border, right in the wilds. And when we arrived on a land, what they use as a football pitch. Wasn't a proper landing place, just a football pitch. But there was a DO there, district officer, and his wife. Now, I got great respect for them. There they were in the wilds and walking around. The women were just had an apron, but the men were walking around completely naked. Completely. That's how remote it was. And there's this man, and he had a few assistants, like XKR, some of them were, as policemen. And there's this young DO running the district. It was so big, almost bigger than this country, I should think. Wonderful, on his own, and he was then acting as district officer in charge of everything. He was the magistrate, he was the chief policeman, chief doctor, everything you can think of.
What sort of age was he? I mean?
He was 26, 28. But some of them had been ex-KAR, so they had the grounding. And they'd volunteer to go back as district officers, like civil servants in that era. And you wouldn't read some wonderful stories of what they did. But I've known, I've visited them, and I've got on the KAR book there, as one of ours used to be a youngster. He was the intelligence officer in 23KR when I was QM. And he later has written a story about his life as a district officer, when he used to meet and recruit ex-KAR, because they were the salt of the earth. They'd gone back to their villages with a very, very small pension, to us a small pension, to them quite some money from which they can build up, and they were respected. So therefore, until later on when they had the mutinies, they controlled the whole country in a way.
So you did the officer training with mixed tribes and so on. So during your 2 years there, how drastically did all this change?
Well, after 12 months, that's the time it took really for the government and everybody else to settle down and see what was going to happen. But unfortunately, as E.D. became, he became a colonel in the end, the CEO of the unit, I got him fitted up, measured by the tailor, sent to Mossbros for suit, and he came back all dressed up, and he was sent off on a course to the UK. And they were, two other officers had gone off. Then somewhere politically, the Israelis volunteered to do the training for the Uganda army.
Mm.
And to do it free. Now, that was because they wanted to get their feet into Africa, like the Chinese wanted to. And then I stayed on with two more, and the Israelis then started training. But they were not liked by the African troops, because they taught them things which we hadn't taught them, like using cheese cutters for strangling people and all that, but they hadn't taught them the basic soldiering. They were very good at doing what they wanted to do, but to teach the African troops things like commander training when they were not up to that standard of doing it.
So what did you feel about the Israelis coming in? I mean, it was...
Well, I met them... Didn't make any difference to me, because I was doing my job and I was about, I could see I would have to go off soon. But what was so silly was, we had to control, I had to control the expenditure on ammunition and things like that. And the British Army has always controlled the expenditure of ammunition. Each soldier, even in my time, we only had about 10 rounds each year for training, which isn't nothing much really. So as soon as the Israelis came in, they gave them hundreds of rounds of fire and they finished up with no ammunition. They didn't realise that somebody had to buy the ammunition.
What sort of chaps were these?
Very good, though. They were all good men.
Were they NCOs or...?
Officers.
They were officers, yeah.
Well, when they came to us, they were, yeah.
And they all spoke English.
They did, but they were, couldn't... They were very surprised at the standard which we were training, and the standard of equipment we had in the my quarters and things like this.
Were they Israeli-born, or were they Europeans?
Very difficult to say. I wouldn't ever get... They were youngish, so probably Israeli-born. Mm. No, they were good people.
But they were sort of special services. They were commando-trained, were they?
No, they were ordinary Israeli, but the Israelis had been... They were trained in a different way to you trained African troops. From basics of recruit, you cannot start off teaching commando training to a recruit.
No.
Or an African who is wonderful at doing... jungle training and things like that. It's a different standard altogether.
How long were the Israelis there?
They were there when I left. No, they were there when I left, yes.
Yeah, quite a while. Yeah. What effect did that have on the sort of cohesion of the army? Because, you know, it sounds as though the British influence was starting to be watered down a bit.
Well, no, we had a mutiny before then, of course.
Right, tell me about that.
Well, they call it a mutiny, but I didn't think it. Anyhow, not long after, about 6 months after independence, there was some trouble. And the Minister of Defence came to see us. And somehow or other, the Africans picked him up at the gate, a group of Africans, took him to the guard room, and I heard about it. And then I collected the African RSM, went with him to the guard room to see, because normally we would have stopped it. But when we got there, there was a very narrow entrance to the guard room, in which the Africans, the few Africans who had done this, were crushed into it, and you couldn't move them. There was chock-a-block almost stuck in the entrance.
What, sort of up against
the gates? Leaving into another room, into the guard room. It was a passage leading to the guard room. So there were sufficient, so many Africans. I would say about, must have been about 20, 30 maximum. The rest of the battalion wasn't there, just these 30. So normally it would have been easy to do something, but you couldn't get at them. So, and the atmosphere was quite reasonable. They were sort of smiling. There was no bad feeling, and I was standing there with the African officer about to do something, and between us we decided. We couldn't touch them on the shoulder and call them out. Or we didn't want to call them out in case they refused. That would have made the problem worse. And as they were quite happy, it seemed reasonable to wait. So they then called for the paymaster, and he went in, and everybody was all smiling and happy. So it was easier to leave it like it was. Otherwise, we would have to get serious. And it, that stage, it's not, although it was called a mutiny later, it wasn't really, it was a go slow. And we found, it, we didn't know until just that same day, that the Uganda government, they had increased the pay of the officers, but hadn't increased the pay of the troops.
So that was their grievance?
That was a grievance. Then we found it happened in the other, in Tanganyika and down in Kenya. So it was a bit tricky. Now, when it was all over, they all went back, a British battalion moved in that night into our camp. Now, because it was a bit tricky, I was dressed all night, waiting to see what was happening. Then I heard some steps, which were not African steps, in boots, walking up at night. And I thought, this is strange. And I could sense it wasn't Africans. So after a couple of hours, a knock on the door, and we found that they were, as the British troops had come to control the camp, which they did in a wonderful way. Took all the arms away. There was no trouble with everybody, because the African troops at that stage, all those who hadn't been at the guard room just wasn't not involved in it.
Yeah.
And there was no bad feeling against the British, because it was against the government for not giving the pay.
So what happened to those who were in the guard
room? When they were picked up, the British selected the ringleaders, took them away, took the arms away, and then they stayed for the 2 days. The wives were then sent away. They went home to UK, except my wife, who stayed in Entebbe. She refused to go. When she got to Entebbe, she said, no, I'll wait. Of course, later on, that didn't help me, because the people who came out said, oh, this is all wrong. Anyhow, this is the start of it. As soon as the troops settled in, the wives had gone, I had a platoon of soldiers in my quarters. The quarters were very close together in the same camp. But I had a platoon to look after me, and the paymaster came to stay with me just to see what was going to happen. At least we were protected by the British troops in case.
Yeah.
We didn't really need it, because I went back to get my staff and carried on the normal way. But after 2 days, they had to move to go back, because everything settled down. But the trouble was...
I'll stop you just there for a second. Arthur Caney, end of reel 13.